Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
It's 6 minutes past five. Welcome to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show. Got a lot of things to talk about today. There are some new ads by Perry. Well, I'm going to let you judge for yourself when we get to that. And I want to remind you, tomorrow at 5 o'clock, the great debate. We're going to have, once again, two very knowledgeable men who are going to debate the question, should drugs be legalized? One is Ted Sumner, who was a deep cover cop in California for many, many years and brought down over 600 drug dealers. He's going to take one side. On the opposite side will be Martin Tanner. Don't miss that show. If you missed the first debate, you missed a great show. But that's tomorrow. Right now, we're going to be talking with author Brant Gardner, the author of The Gift and the Power. Brant, welcome to K-Talk.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. We've got an audience that's split between LDS and non-LDS people, so I want to make sure that people understand why this. What's important about this to anybody? The LDS people know and understand the power behind this. The non-LDS people would say, who cares, maybe. What's the significance of the book?
When you talk about where the Book of Mormon came from, there's always questions about, you know, authorship. And, of course, those who are LDS believe that it comes from God, and those who aren't look for other kinds of explanations. No matter who you are, however, you've got the history of the book that you have to deal with. We know that it came through Joseph Smith's hands, and the question is, how did it do that? And part of the impetus for working on the book is some of the work that I've done with the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research, or FAIR. They answer questions that people have, and a lot of people had questions about the translation and how it happened and, you know, what was the role of a seer stone in the translation. So a lot of the beginning of the book was to try to answer those questions. So for believers, it's, you know, what was the process and how did it work? And for those who don't, it's still part of the process. What was the role of the seer stone and how did it work? And what about all these questions of magic and the occult and, you know, do they play into it? So that's a lot of what at least the beginning of the book is about.
All right, let's dive in. What about the seer stone? What role did it play, and what was it?
The seer stone is, you know, from our standpoint, from modern science looking at it, the seer stone is a rock. It has a different significance to the people that had a use for it. And traditionally, it was something that people would use to see things that they couldn't otherwise see. And that's why they called it a seer stone. It's something that has a very long history in the world. There are people who've used stones for seeing for a long time. Other people have used other means. They use, the polished thumbnail. The Romans used to look at the glint coming off of a sword. The Maya would use an obsidian mirror, and some of them use crystal stones today. So this process of using some physical thing so that you can see something that you would not normally see is something that's happened throughout history. It's happened widely enough that we really ought to have an explanation for it that's better than saying it's mystical.
All right. This sort of sounds like the origins of the crystal ball or the mythical crystal skull.
Yeah, the crystal ball was part of that tradition. It was one of those things that you would look at, and as you looked at it, you would see something else. And, of course, from the modern perspective, we look at that and we say, wow, that was, you know, magic stuff. That was mystical. if you take a more scientific approach to it, you say, you know, there were all these people who were seeing things throughout history, across cultures. If that many people are doing something and claiming the same thing, what's really going on? And it turns out that you can come up with a more modern scientific explanation for why people would use a stone or the glint off of a sword or a crystal ball to see something. And it has to do with the vision system. We know that the brain sees, the eyes don't see. So the light comes in through the eyes, but everything's processed in the brain. And the brain's what actually creates the image. And that's the reason that the brain can create an image, and then we can see it even if there's no light coming into our eyes. And probably the best thing that is a dream. We all see things in our dreams, but our eyes are not open. There's no light coming into them, and yet we see. For a lot of people, not everyone, but for a number of people, they're able to do something that distorts vision, and in the process of distorting their vision so that they know they're not seeing through their eyes, other images appear, and those are the people that, through history, have been called seers because they see things that other people don't see in these certain conditions.
Is there any Christian reference or any precursor to this?
Yeah, the Christian use, well, I suppose Christian, in that it's Judeo-Christian, you go back to the Urim and Thummim in the Bible, which is also, it's told, you know, it's about lights, but they talk about stones that are used as the Urim and Thummim, and they're used as a means of prophecy. So it appears that there was a period of time in the Old Testament when there was something like this that was happening, and that there was some stone that was used in the process of receiving revelation. We have so little information about how they were used that you can't say for certain what the mechanism was, but it's certainly possible that it was the same kind of thing, where somebody would see something that everyone understood they could not be seeing with their normal eyes.
All right, let's delve for a minute into some of the historic aspects of this. One of the old saws that keeps coming up is that Solomon Spaulding really was the author.
Yeah. That's an interesting theory, and you come up with that based on the fact that Joseph Smith is an improbable author. And once you agree that Joseph Smith, really from his own education and his own learning, wouldn't be able to produce a book like the Book of Mormon, you look around and you say, well, okay, who else might it have been? And there was a manuscript that Solomon Spaulding had written, a novel that talked about Romans who had come to the New World and left behind this this book. And so you had some parallel. The really cool thing was that the book didn't exist at the time. No one had any copy of it. You had people who had read it a number of years before, and so they would ask them, do you think this is similar to the Book of Mormon? And apparently power of suggestion lined the two of them up, and people would say, oh yeah, those are the names, and I've read this, and boy, some of the names of the Book of Mormon showed up in Solomon Spaulding. And their reminiscences really made it sound like Solomon Spaulding might have been the cause or the, you know, ultimate source behind the Book of Mormon. All of that was very plausible until they found Solomon Spaulding's manuscript. And it's available now. You can purchase it in print. There's a couple of places where you can find it online. Once you've read it, you will realize there's absolutely no correlation between the two at all. All of the similarity was due to mistaken reminiscences.
What about writing style? In your research, undoubtedly you've come across the computer programs that can detect a writing style of a particular author out of a manuscript. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, that's called stylometrics. Certainly I don't do it. I've read some of the reports, and because they deal with statistics, they're kind of way beyond anything that I do very well. But I know, so the idea is that you can take certain aspects of a text and test it to find out who the author might be. They've had some really good success in identifying United States historical documents, some of which I think in the Federalist Papers they weren't sure quite who the author was, and Stylometrics was able to assign an author based on the style. Those kinds of things have been applied to the Book of Mormon. One of the things that happened recently is someone decided to take that approach and go to the Solomon Spaulding manuscript, and they came up with this conclusion that, you know, maybe that's really what it was. Recently, there's been some more research with some people who know the methods better and the statistics better, and they've gone through and found out that the methodology of that particular project was incorrect, and that none of the conclusions they came to can be justified. So,
I also had heard from one source that when they did the Stylometrics, that they found writing styles from multiple authors. Is that accurate?
Yes. That's been not only reported, it's been maybe at least 20 years, I think, that the first study was done on the Book of Mormon, where they discovered that there were multiple authors represented in the Book of Mormon. And then when those studies were questioned, they went back and sort of redid them with different and more stringent analysis and came up with the same conclusion. So there are some stylometric analyses of the Book of Mormon that indicate that there were multiple authors behind it, and certainly Joseph Smith was not one of them.
Interesting. As you stated, he is a very improbable author because of his lack of education, his rural background, and some of the ideas put forth are way ahead of their time. And in terms of later archaeological findings that have borne out some of these things.
Yeah, and that's really one of the questions that you have when you look at Joseph Smith translating and using the seer stone. One of the things that I had to do in the book was simply posit that it was a translation so that I could find out what kind it was. But when you look at that whole question of where in the world did the Book of Mormon come from, regardless of what methodology Joseph might have used, regardless of the scientific explanation that we might have behind why he would see something in the seer stone, above and beyond all that, the content of the Book of Mormon is inexplicable. You cannot say that Joseph Smith, because of his education or anything else that he did, would have come up with it. And a lot of what's happened in the last, let's give it 30 years. In the last 30 years, there have been a lot of work trying to associate the Book of Mormon with a plausible New World context. One of the earliest proponents of that to, you know, give a good geography of it was John L. Sorensen, and he locates most of the Book of Mormon events in southern Chiapas and sort of that adjacent area of Guatemala. And he looked then at that area and said, does this information fit with the people that's there? And he came up with some pretty good correlations. I took a lot of that information and said, you know, based on what we know of Mesoamerica, does that help us learn something about the Book of Mormon? And it turns out that if you read the Book of Mormon against a Mesoamerican context and you say that's the cultural background that is informing all of the actions that no one tells you about, then it really fits very well with what we know of the history and the reason why people do things.
Hold that thought.
Yeah.
We'll come right back to it. We've got a short commercial break. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on K-Talk.
AM 630 K-Talk. Real people. Real talk. Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
524 in the Mountain West, we're talking with Brent Gardner, author of The Gift and Power. And it's rather interesting on some of the things that you have pointed out. We interrupted you in the middle of a thought.
Yeah, if I can reconstruct where the thought was going, the idea is that what we want to do with the Book of Mormon is see if we can place it against a background in a culture that help us understand why the actions took place. And it turns out that Mesoamerica and their culture and the particular things that were happening in that culture can explain things about the Book of Mormon that otherwise you look at them and say, well, that's interesting, but why would anybody do that? And I'll give you what I hope is a quick example. Jacob talks about some real terrible things that he sees happening with his people right after they get to the New World, somewhere within the first 50 years. And he says, you know, they've got these two problems. One of them is polygamy, and the other is that people are wearing costly apparel. And he gives a sermon that deals with both of those. Those seem to be two kind of unrelated things, and you don't really know why they're such a big problem until you see them against the context of what was happening in the Mesoamerican world at the time. And what was happening was an economic separation. People were becoming richer, and the way they were doing it was through economic trade. The way they would show their wealth wasn't to put it in banks because they didn't exist. They would wear their wealth. So costly apparel was this demonstration of the wealth of the people. And the people who were getting wealthy were the ones who were producing things. They produce more, you wanted a cottage industry, and the way they were producing things was to have more than one wife, so they'd have larger families and basically a bigger family practice and family factory. So if you look at what was happening at that time period, now you know exactly why you have those particular conditions that at that time you have a prophet of the Lord that says, boy, something's wrong here. So he was dealing with current events of the day.
Interesting. What kind of reception have you had with this? I would assume the naysayers come out in force.
Not specifically to a lot of the things that I've talked about, because, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't have a wide readership. But what tends to happen on the Book of Mormon is people will focus on individual things, and they will say, find me this artifact, or, you know, find me some archaeological proof of the Book of Mormon. And that turns out to be the wrong question to ask. If you have a group of perhaps 40 people, which is about all we can really account for coming across in the ship with Lehi, and they land somewhere in Mesoamerica about 600 BC, we know that there were people there. In fact, along the coast of Guatemala, where they would have arrived, there were about seven cities of well over 1,000 people each that were up in the foothills and probably had a line of sight to be able to see somebody, and particularly a sail on the horizon. So you get this small group of people coming into a larger group. Several things are going to happen. One of them, it's brand new, and they've got a brand new material culture, so very, very soon all of the things they wear and the pots they eat off of and everything else are going to be native-made, and probably made in the way the natives know how to do it, because it fits both the materials available and the climate. Their houses are going to look like other people's houses, and it doesn't take too long before language changes. So you're not going to find too much material culture from the old world. What we're going to find is textual archaeology, in other words, going through the text and finding out where the text tells us that it's reflecting a culture, rather than us saying, I really need to find a menorah in Mesoamerica.
Interesting. Where is your book available?
The best place to pick it up is online at fairlds.org. They have a bookstore, and they tend to sell it at a discount, which is kind of nice for people who want to buy things.
That's F-A-I-R-L-D-S?
F-A-I-R-L-D-S.org. And it's also available on Amazon. So you can get it in both places. For the new book on the translation process, it's also available in a Kindle edition through Amazon. And, of course, that one's only through Amazon and not through Fair.
Excellent. The correct title, again?
Is The Gift and Power, Translating the Book of Mormon. And that one deals just with the process of translation. The one that deals a little bit more with cultural information is one that came out a few years back. It's called Second Witness, an analytical and contextual commentary on the Book of Mormon.
Good reference text. I find this fascinating. Are you going to be having any lectures or seminars in the Salt Lake area?
No, at least not until perhaps August when FAIR does its next conference. I might be speaking at that. I've spoken at several of them. But again, for people who are interested in such things, at the fairlds.org website, there are some papers that I've delivered on those topics that they can find. And the good news is those are free.
We'll have you back again when it comes close to the time when those conferences are going to be held, because I think it would be a very fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Brant, appreciate your being with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure, sir.
This is Religion Today with Martin Tanner, a weekly look at religion and spirituality here at home and around the world. Now, here's your host, Martin Tanner.
Welcome. This is Religion Today. I'm your host, Martin Tanner. Today, we look at a fascinating subject, one that I've thought about a lot, but I'm sure not near as much as our guest, Brant Gardner. His book is called The Gift and Power, Translating the Book of Mormon. And the subject matter is, of course, how Joseph Smith actually translated the Book of Mormon. This is a fascinating book, and welcome to Religion Today, Brant.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. How did you come to write this book? How did this subject matter fascinate you the way it seems to have me as well?
I started working, going through the Book of Mormon, oh, it must be 16 years ago now. And because of internet friends, I started doing a commentary online of the Book of Mormon, going through it very, very slowly. And if you go through it slowly, these questions of how the translation occurred pop up frequently when you see it. So it was always something in the back of my mind. Then after I finished the commentary, it was time to be serious about it and try to come up with some sort of answer to the question. So I've spent about the last 4 years trying to take all the evidence that I could and come up with some sort of solution, at least some idea, of how Joseph Smith might have translated the Book of Mormon.
For our listeners who may not be aware of some of these different competing theories that are out there, you have perhaps at one extreme, though, and I hate to use the word extreme because I find, you know, Royal Skousen a wonderful, delightful guy, but he is at one end of the spectrum, believing that this is a very literal word-for-word translation that was directly given to Joseph Smith. That would have been something like David Whitmer believed as well. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have people like, oh, I guess Blake Osler and many others who think that there was just this core concept that was given by revelation to Joseph Smith, and he sort of expounded upon it in his own words. I mean, both of those theories have their shortcomings, and no one has a really comprehensive theory of how this took place, at least I think until your book. I think you have us close to something that really answers all of the questions about the translation that I've ever seen.
Well, thank you. It's a question that really has to be answered based on some sort of indication of the evidence and the data. And the problem isn't in just the assembling of the data, but in the interpretation. So you mentioned Royal Skousen. His research on the Book of Mormon and, you know, the manuscripts and what went into it and all of the variations is absolutely without peer. And I don't have any qualms about any of the data that he's put together specifically, but the interpretation of it is always different. On the other end, of course, we've got Blake Osler, and again, he's looking at certain kinds of data, and it's the interpretation. So all of us are interpreting a group of information to see what we can come up with. What I've tried to do is take as much of it as I can, not simply the ones that support a pre-existing notion of what I think it might have been, and then try to come up with something that says, okay, with this wide range of data, is there anything that we can do that will help us understand how it all fits together?
Just a few examples to bring our listeners up to speed. You have King James English, not just in the translation, well, not in the Isaiah phrases that are quoted. You also have similar kinds of phrases, jot and tittle, those sorts of things, atonement, other words and phrases out of the King James Bible. You have new untranslated words like personal names in there, Nephi, Lehi. You have different things like that. And then you have tossed into the mix things that are very obviously the kinds of words that Joseph Smith himself might have used. You have the phrase adu that is so frequently mentioned by other people, and you have the fact that Joseph Smith himself actually made changes to the manuscripts. And when you see all those things and many, many others that our author today has mentioned, how do you account for all of these in coming up with a theory about how Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon, since he's not here to ask?
I think any author that goes through and writes a book and looks at all of the data has some idea of what they think they're going to say before they start writing. And I actually had an idea of what I thought based on everything that I'd seen going through the Book of Mormon. And if I could give just a quick synopsis of different kinds of translations you might have, some translations are literal in that they try very, very hard to keep both the syntax and the vocabulary of the original and reproduce it as much as possible. Then you have others that are close to the text, but they take a little bit more liberty and they may change things around. And one of the reasons for doing that is just translating things like idioms. For instance, if somebody says, boy, that's just like a barrel of monkeys, if you take it too literally, you wonder why in the world there's a barrel of monkeys sitting in your text. For those of who know what the idiom means, it means something entirely different. To communicate that meaning, you don't want to be literal, you want to be more conceptual or more functional in the translation. And then the far end of things is a conceptual translation that perhaps is similar to what some of the real modern translations of the Bible are like, when they just try to communicate the meaning and they really don't worry about communicating specific vocabulary. When I went through the Book of Mormon originally, I thought it was all going to fall into that middle category of a functional translation. And evidence for that would be things like the jot and the tittle that was certainly related to meaning that might have been there, but those words, because they relate to something that occurred after the people in the Book of Mormon left the old world, could not have been part of the plate text. So there's other words like that that would lead me to believe that it was functional. And then I started looking at the data, and I found out that while I still believe that most of it is a functional translation, some things just really look like they're literal, and most of those are names. A lot of the names in the Book of Mormon just have non-random correlations to names from the old world. There's just no way to get that many of them that are that accurate. So those seem to have been translated pretty literally. And then every once in a while I saw something that I thought might be conceptual. So I was kind of surprised when I went through and looked at all of the evidence that it wasn't all the one thing that I expected, that the data actually told me there was something else.
And so what kind of a conclusion did you draw? How did Joseph Smith go about the translation process, or how did it occur when all this data that you had before you was taken into account?
What you have to take into account, of course, is what Joseph produced, and then you have to work backwards. Joseph Smith really never told us how he translated. Frankly, I suspect he didn't understand himself how he did it. Anytime he was asked, he said, it's through the gift and power of God, hence the name of the book, making sure that we understood that this is what we're talking about. So Joseph understood that, you know, there was some higher power involved in this process of translation. He wouldn't have been able to say exactly what the relationship was to the text. In looking at everything I can see about how the translation occurred, one of the things that you learn if you are either a translator, or particularly if you're bilingual, you understand that people can comprehend something sort of away from the language. You can understand something prior to the time that you put it into words.
Hold that thought. We are approaching the top of the hour here. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Brant Gardner. He is the author of a spectacular book, Translating the Book of Mormon. It talks about how Joseph Smith actually accomplished the task with the gift and power of God. When we come back, more about that. Stay tuned. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today on KSL. We're back. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today. If you'd like to be in touch with me about this or any other subjects, send me an email. Send it to martinstanner@gmail.com. Today, our guest is Brant Gardner. He's written a book called Translating the Book of Mormon, and that is exactly what it discusses. This is a wonderful book, and before our time gets away from us, Brant, tell our listeners how they can get a copy of this if they are so inclined.
One of the best ways to get it is to go online to fairlds.org and go to their bookstore. They tend to discount things, and it's a good organization to support. Amazon.com has them, and we just learned today that they should be on the shelves at Deseret Book.
It's a great book, and if you have an interest in this kind of subject, take a look at it. It's by far the most comprehensive thing that has ever been written on the subject matter. When we took our break, you were talking about how we account for all of the things that we find in the Book of Mormon, which are seemingly a very literal translation, conceptual things, idiomatic phrases, and things of that nature.
Yes, and I suppose one of the things that I ought to mention, you know, as we're continuing this discussion, I believe that for all of the divine inspiration that Joseph had, he was a human being and his brain worked. And I think that God works with the material that he has. And so some of the answers about the nature of translation deal with the nature of language and the way the brain works. Steven Pinker has explained that we have this concept, or he uses the concept of mentalese to talk about what language is like before we put it into words. And in his discussion, he says, you know, if you ever had the experience of saying something and realizing that wasn't what you meant to say, then there has to be something that you meant to say that's prior to the creation of language. And I've seen people who've been very thoroughly bilingual, who can easily move between languages, and they're not translating. They're not taking one and moving it into another. They simply know what they want to say, and it comes out in a particular language. So I think what happens with Joseph Smith is that the content of the plates is given to Joseph through divine intervention, some divine method, and it's given to him at the level of mental ease prior to language, and then through the normal process of Joseph converting what he understands into language, then we get the language that we see in the Book of Mormon. So certain vocabulary terms that he's familiar with are going to show up. For instance, he talks about harrowing up your soul. Well, the harrow is a farm implement that he would have been familiar with, would not have been familiar in the ancient New World. But that concept of what it does and what it means in that image certainly would have been something that was appropriate. The particular word that he chose was appropriate to his time. We talked about the jot and the tittle, very important scripture that he would have been very familiar with, and very much reason why he would use that kind of a language. So when we look at the Book of Mormon and we see that there's a lot of language in there that replicates things in the King James Version, and sometimes New Testament passages, even though the actual text was pre-Christ, it's easily explained by the fact that those were very, very familiar to him. I was in a Greek class once, and the teacher gave us an assignment to translate something out of Matthew. And although in most cases, if you hand out text and you say, translate this, you give it to 30 people and you'll get 30 different translations, because we all recognized it as a scripture, every one of us gave exactly the same thing, and there may be a, you know, a word or two different, but basically we repeated the King James Version because that was the model that we had. And as soon as we knew that's what it meant, we went to that language and that vocabulary. So it's certainly not surprising that that would be what happened with Joseph Smith as well.
And we tend to go to the text, as you say, that we're familiar with. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, as the King James and the Tyndale stuff. If you go earlier than that, then you get the spirit is sick, or the flesh is sick, but the spirit is willing, which is the earliest English translation, which just doesn't resonate with anybody because it's so familiar in a language that we're familiar with. Anyway, one of the things that has always fascinated me about the Book of Mormon is that Joseph Smith made so many changes and corrections to the printer's manuscript after it was penned, after it was on paper, and yet during the translation process itself, he didn't go back very often unless the scribe had made some kind of an error. Explain to our audience how something like that would be possible.
One of the things that a lot of the early saints thought was because Joseph Smith dictated it without any changes, it did not appear that there was an error. And so they took their idea of an inerrant scripture and they said, oh, Joseph must have dictated it just exactly the way it was supposed to be, and God meant every word to be just where they were. Pretty clearly, Joseph didn't think of the text that way because he would go back through and make the corrections.
Exactly.
So when he's going through the first time, he gives the translation as best he can. Then when he has time to look at it, he may say to himself, oh, that word doesn't seem quite right, or there's a better explanation for that, or let me change this. And he's thoroughly willing to be able to make those kinds of changes because he doesn't hold the words themselves to be God-given. It's the meaning and the content that he thinks is important.
Absolutely so. And when he goes back, he's changing grammar and trying to make things more understandable. But when he does that, he is not correcting or out of whole cloth changing a proper name anywhere that I've been able to discern.
No, although what's fascinating, of course, is that we assume that he must have known everything about the text. And some of the things that Royal Skousen has found out is that neither he nor Oliver Cowdery, as the scribe, really understood it terribly well, because we get some interesting spelling changes in there that make it look like we've got two different people, the Amlicites and the Amalekites. And turns out they're exactly the same person, and somehow neither Joseph nor Oliver understood that. So, you know, they translated it, but they certainly didn't understand everything about it, which, again, means that it's a translation and not something that they would have made up.
Absolutely so. And, of course, during this era, no one, well, or any other era, probably no one else could have translated from the original plates themselves. They were covered up during most of the translation process.
Right. We have no indication that they were directly consulted.
Exactly. This was a divine inspiration. So, how is it that Oliver Cowdery and some of these other scribes seem to come up with ideas about how the Book of Mormon was actually translated? Do you think Joseph Smith told them some things that weren't spoken out in public by him, or are these more speculations? We've heard the story about the hat.
We have the story that says he, you know, put the stone in the hat and that he would see words. Joseph does not appear to have been the one who mentioned that. Other people do. where these things come from, probably from the same thing that people like me try to find out how the translation happened. We look at it, nobody's told us, and so we say, boy, I wonder how that might have happened. And certainly a lot of the people that Joseph was familiar with tried to find an answer. I strongly suspect that Joseph never told them anything other than what we have printed, which, as he said, it was through the gift and power of God. And so they took whatever evidence they could see and came up with the best answer they could come up with. And in cases, kind of took their assumptions, such as it must have been absolutely perfect, and sort of took that interpretation on the data, and then they would come up with answers of how the translation happened.
We are out of time. Brant Gardner, thanks for joining us today. His book is Translating the Book of Mormon. It's a wonderful look at how the Book of Mormon was actually translated. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today. Join me next week.